had to sleep last night. If not well, then take heart, because according to one researcher, since 2003, we've been in the golden age of sleep research. Thousands of papers on everything from the sleep problems of Chinese children to the sleep behavior of the wild black rhinoceros. So, why do 50 to 70 million Americans suffer a chronic sleep disorder, according to the Academy of Sciences? Why do almost 5% of adults admit to nodding off while they drive? The Department of Transportation calls it DYD, driving while drowsy. It kills 1,500 people a year. Why, according to a 2011 poll, did 2/3 of respondents say they weren't rested even though they tried to sleep? Why? Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker who's also constantly tired. She knew she was a fitful sleeper, but set out to find out more. Her article is titled Up All Night, and she joins us from the studios of Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. So, Betsy, how are you feeling today? Did you get any sleep last night?
You know, I actually slept pretty well last night, so I feel pretty good. Thanks.
Well, and can you tell? I mean, do you have bad days when you have bad nights?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of assume that's true for everybody. If you didn't get enough sleep, you sort of drag through the day. A lot of people get a headache, I think, and you just have trouble focusing.
We're glad you're not feeling that way. But take us through some of what you found. You introduced us right off the bat to the father of modern sleep research, Nathaniel Kleitman. What did he do?
Well, for a very long time, you know, even as a lot of areas of human physiology were sort of racing forward, sleep was just, as one person has described it, as sort of a blind spot in the study of human physiology. And people didn't really look at it because they just considered it something, some sort of an absence. You weren't, when you were sleeping, you weren't dead, and you also weren't alert, and you also weren't comatose. So it was defined by what it wasn't. And Kleitman got interested in it. He was really one of the first people who really did rigorous studies of sleep. And because he sort of saw it as something more active. There was something going on while you sleep. And when you think about it, you really spend a lot of your life asleep. You spend about 1/3 of your life asleep. So it's a pretty significant chunk of time to be, as it were, doing nothing.
Right. Well, one of the things he tried to do was stay awake. You know, he tried to keep other people awake to study them, but he stayed awake 115 hours straight.
Right, and started hallucinating at the end of it. He was interested in, I mean, the flip side of sleep is, of course, sleeplessness. So people who study sleep often tend to study lack of sleep, too.
He began hallucinating, kind of making odd statements. He also tried to stay awake in a cave in Kentucky. He tried to alter the day, tried to impose a 28-hour day on himself, and he couldn't.
Right. He was sort of operating under this belief that our days are constructed. We construct our days. It's just a sort of societal construction. And he was in Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, and if you went underground where you weren't subject to light cues and things like that, you could change your day. And it turned out he couldn't. He acknowledged that he couldn't.
Yeah. So there's some discovery there that, you know, there's some sort of reason we have this 24-hour clock. By the way, it's fascinating. You point out the initial sleep research was sponsored by companies that were hoping to sell their product. You know, Ovaltine, Meat Packers, Swift wanted to somehow prove that eating protein had to do with better sleep. But Kleitman then stumbles across another researcher who's doing something with a machine. What is that machine, and what did their work lead to?
Well, this was really one of his graduate students, and his graduate student desperately needed a topic for a dissertation. And he had what I'm going to call an electroencephalogram machine, an early one, and it measured your brain waves, and it scribbled across about a half a mile of paper every night. And he was first working on babies, and then he started working on adults, and he discovered what is now called rapid eye movement sleep, which he actually, this graduate student, wanted to call jerky eye movement sleep. but it became known to all the world as REM sleep.
Right. And what did they learn from learning that?
Well, this is sort of part of this, if you want to say, evolution in thinking about sleep that Kleitman initiated, which is that sleep is really a very active time of our lives, and sleep has different stages. Everyone cycles through these four stages of sleep every night, basically. Stage 1, 2, 3, 4, they have different brain patterns. Different things are going on, as it were, while you go through those different cycles of sleep. Your most vivid dreams tend to take place in REM sleep, but it's now known actually that you dream in really all stages of sleep.
Well, and they went on from there to learn that, you know, mice and birds and insects all have their own sleep patterns. So great, you know, fantastic discovery. Why is it that here we are so many years later, you know, people just aren't sleeping well? How is it that we made that discovery and it didn't then translate into, you know, voila, and here's how we're going to solve sleep problems?
Right. Well, there's a certain amount of debate about that. I mean, in the piece, I sort of looked at three different books that take somewhat different approaches to answering that question. But some people would blame modern life, you know, and if you just look at how, if you think of sleep as something that evolved over many, many millions of years, which it did, because we know that sleep has a long evolutionary history, and even organisms that are very, very unrelated, you know, very distantly related to us, have something that is like sleep, how's that, if it's not quite sleep. Mm-hmm. And so if you think of it as a response to darkness, let's say, right, then, well, then it used to be, and certainly if you, you know, if you lived near the equator, let's say, then it was dark almost 12 hours a day. And so people were inactive at probably for about 12 hours a day, and they slept for part of that maybe, and then they woke up. And there's a lot of evidence that before electric light, people didn't sleep in these, you know, 8-hour chunks that we leave ourselves. We only leave ourselves 8 hours to sleep. They slept in bursts really more. And maybe different people were awake during different parts of the night. There's some question about evolutionarily, would it have been beneficial, you know, for everyone to sleep at once? Not really. Someone was going to be on the lookout. Maybe that's why people at different ages tend to sleep in different parts of the night.
Huh.
So there's a question of whether modern life, where we have artificial light, where we stay up in front of computer screens and where we're working till very late, and then we suddenly say, let's say 11 o'clock, okay, now we're going to go to sleep and sleep for 8 hours. That's just not something that our bodies really are evolutionarily prepared to do.
Well, that brings us to Matthew Wolfmeyer, an anthropologist who's written one of the books you're talking about. We've spoken about this on the program before. He talks about consolidated and unconsolidated sleep, this idea that maybe we used to sleep in blocks instead of that idea that 8 hours starting at 11, ending at 7.
Right, and he writes at the beginning of his book that a lot of people are attracted to it because they themselves are have trouble sleeping or have weird sleep patterns. And he looks at the question, you know, how are we really designed to sleep? And he takes the view that when we used to have these very, very long work days during the Industrial Revolution, people, you know, were expected to work very, very long hours, and then there was only a very limited block for sleep, and that's how we sort of developed the social rules and norms about what is normal sleep, normative sleep, and he thinks that many people's bodies just don't conform to that.
New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert, we're going to pick up on that, but what do you do short of medication to sleep? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Colbert, whose New Yorker article Up All Night explores insomnia, including her own. She was just telling us that the idea of sleeping 8 consecutive hours was only born during the Industrial Revolution, when industry needed people to punch a clock at a certain time. Before that, people were known to sleep in blocks of time, dividing up their shut eye into something they called first and second sleep. And Betsy, so you write that Benjamin Franklin liked to spend the period between these so-called two sleeps reading naked in his favorite chair.
Right. I mean, once again, when you start to think about it, you know, even the very long workday, you know, sort of Industrial Revolution style, you know, 16-hour workday couldn't really happen until you had artificial light. Because, you know, it would just get dark and you couldn't work anymore. And in Benjamin Franklin's days, you know, most people probably still functioned more or less with the sun. You know, you certainly had candles and lanterns and things like that, but you didn't have electric lighting. So you were really at the mercy of whether there was enough light to do anything, to see anything.
Well, as you point out, one of the things they might have done between those two blocks of sleep, if they got up at midnight and stayed up for a couple of hours, they might have prayed, chatted, or made love.
Yes, many people apparently said that was the best time to have sex, in between your first sleep and your second sleep. It was purported to be a particularly amorous time.
Well, again, with no electricity,
Yeah, exactly.
Not much else to do. Well, now we move to Till Ronneberg. His book is Internal Time, Chronotypes, Social Jet Lag, and Why You're So Tired. He breaks sleepers into two camps, larks and owls. And again, this may be just, you know, the people that you come from. What's the difference between a lark and an owl?
Well, everyone sort of knows larks and owls, right? Everyone knows people who, and is one themselves to varying degrees. Either you like to stay up late, you know, long after it does get dark and wake up late, or you like to go to bed, you know, more or less at dusk and get up early.
And, that's the lark.
Right. Sorry, that's the lark, exactly, the early bird. And people do tend to have pretty heavily genetically, you know, wired chronotypes, according to him, and he's done a lot of work himself. He's a doctor, a physician, and a medical researcher in Germany, actually, and has massive amounts of data on this. But also, people's chronotypes tend to change with age, something he also talks about in the book. So little kids tend to be larks and get up very early and drive their parents absolutely insane, you know, by getting up at dawn. And teenagers, this was one of the most interesting things, I think, about his book. Teenagers tend to go in the way opposite direction. They tend to be extreme owls. And this is why kids in high schools are often so groggy for, you know, the better part of the day. And he recommends, actually, that schools start later. They should start later in the day. And he, for teenagers, for adolescents. And he cites some pretty compelling research that suggests that schools that have, the very few schools that have switched their schedules, they find that the kids do learn better.
Well, there's a statistic from Minnesota, a school district there. The average SAT scores went up 200 points by allowing kids to sleep in. That's amazing.
Yeah, it amazed, I think, the people in the district.
Well, and the third book is by someone who you might identify with. He's not a doctor, but he has problems with sleep. It's David Randall. His book is Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. He writes about a field called fatigue management. Is he the one that suggests that the problem is that we are not, as we should be, sleeping alone?
Well, he cites people who advocate that position, and I guess there are a bunch of them out there, pretty well-established sleep researchers who have done studies where they compare how people sleep when they're sleeping together as a couple or when they're sleeping apart. And although they tend to report that they slept better when they slept in the same bed, in fact, you know, when you hook them up to a machine, you find that they've actually spent more of the night in a deeper level of sleep when they've been sleeping separately.
So the producers of The Lucy Show and The Mary Tyler Moore Show had it right when they had them each in their own separate twin bed?
Well, yeah, and it goes even further than that. I mean, Dave Randall in that book cites some statistics about people now building master bedrooms, so people wouldn't even, you know, sleep in the same room. And that this is kind of a trend, apparently, in the building world.
Downton Abbey all over again. Well, so what about you? You had sleep problems. You went to a sleep disorder center in Albany, up in New York. And what did you find out about your sleep that you didn't know, that was contrary to what you thought?
I knew that I was waking up a lot during the night, which is, you know, one of the reasons I was there and one of the reasons I was interested in this whole subject. But when I actually saw the results of this study that they had done, where I'd woken up, I think it was 141 times in the course of a night, I was really quite shocked and horrified.
Well, but what do you do with that information? I mean, it feels as if we have all this technology, we can strap things on, we can go into these sleep centers and they can tell you, guess what, you're not getting REM sleep, or guess what, you were actually awake more than you were asleep. You don't want to steer people towards medication. What do you do with that knowledge?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, I'm still sleeping quite, you know, badly. But I think that I should say that people probably need to experiment with different things and that work for them. And one thing that I think, just from my own personal experience, seems to be important is this idea that we, you know, are all sort of busy, as it were, up to the moment that we then expect to go to sleep. And that's probably not the way our bodies work.
Can't stop on a dime.
Exactly.
Yeah. Elizabeth Colbert, her research into insomnia, her own and the history of it is reported in the New Yorker magazine. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. Elizabeth, thank you. Sweet dreams.
Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Sleep Center advised Betsy not to go to bed until she's tired, not to stay in bed when she can't sleep, and to eliminate alcohol in the evening. Her diagnosis? Difficulty with sleep maintenance. Others call it sleep hygiene. No napping, no TV or computer right before sleeping, no exercise, nicotine, alcohol, caffeine, or spicy food for several hours before. And what about medication? Well, Americans filled some 60 million prescriptions for sleeping pills in 2012. That's up from 47 million in 2006. And a 2012 study found people regularly taking sleep aids were nearly five times as likely to die over 2.5 years. Now, don't panic. The other advice is never quit sleeping aids cold turkey. Ask for a referral to a doctor who specializes in sleep medicine and research. Latest news is next, here and now.